Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
The Vatican has announced plans for the first meeting of a new phase of the official Anglican-Catholic dialogue, which will take place from May the 17th to 27th at the Monastery of Bose in the north of Italy. 10 Anglican and 10 Catholic experts in ecumenism will discuss the theme Church as Communion, Local and Universal, looking at how this relationship affects the two churches' teaching on the ethical questions of our day. But how will this new phase of the dialogue be affected by the recent establishment of the new ordinariate for former Anglicans? What are the expectations for these talks, and how will they be received by ordinary Anglicans and Catholics in the pews? To find out more, I spoke to Monsignor Mark Langham, the Catholic co-secretary of this third phase of the Archic Dialogue.
It's a theme which really arose out of the discussions of the Holy Father and Archbishop Rowan Williams when they met in Rome, and very much relate to issues that are affecting the Anglican communion at the moment. Discussions on what makes the church, on how individual churches relate to the wider communion. And so the main topic of conversation is about communion at the universal and local level. This is an issue which is very germane to what is happening within the Anglican communion, and as with all the archic and other ecumenical dialogues, is something that can really contribute to that communion's understanding of how it should go forward.
Beyond that, though, you're looking also at how this relates to the very pressing ethical questions that both churches are facing.
Yes, inevitably, those are a very much part of the scene that we'll be looking at. But, I mean, I'd have to say that we are not simply diving in and talking about those, as they're called, hot-button issues. We're trying to go behind them and see really where those differences arise. This goes back to the nature of ecumenical dialogue in itself, where we begin by stressing what we have in common, finding an area that we can both profess together, and then moving forward from that to finding where and when and why we diverge. That's a more productive and creative way of addressing our issues. If we simply dive in and talk about the controversial issues as they are, people tend to entrench, they tend to state set positions, and we really don't get anywhere. The great thing about ecumenical dialogue is that it tries to go behind these issues and find out if we can see what is underneath them, what lies behind that we can share in common. And this provides a way that we can move forward.
So what kind of expectations do you have for this new phase? I mean, it's true to say that many people tend to look at the Anglican communion and say, well, they've got all sorts of problems, they're going to have to resolve them before we can resume our ecumenical conversation.
Ecumenical conversation is not just about discussing things when we've got things sorted out. Ecumenical conversation is very much about discerning the will of God through the Holy Spirit for us here and now. And at this time, which is a difficult time, it's perhaps more important than ever that we both try and listen out to the will of God for the Church. What we're always saying is that ecumenism is not a work of human hands. It is actually the desire of God, the prayer of our Lord for his church. We're trying to clear away some of the clouds of human misapprehension so that we can understand more fully the will of God for his church. In that light, we must always work, and perhaps even more work when times are difficult, at trying to come together, to proclaim the gospel together, to discern God's will for his church together. So, to answer your question, it's very hard to say what our expectations for outcomes are. That's in the hands of God. What I do think it is extremely important that we do is come together and talk at this difficult time to affirm what we have in common and affirm our belief that the Lord is calling us together eventually in corporate unity.
The meeting will be taking place in a particularly appropriate ecumenical setting, won't it?
The Monastery of Beausée is a wonderful setting to hold our particular dialogue. It is an ecumenical monastery. Somebody said it's a bit like Taizé with doctoral degrees. It's a very evocative place, and it's extremely well known both to Roman Catholics and to Anglicans. At the last Lambeth conference, the Monastery of Beausée sent a representative at the particular request of the Archbishop of Canterbury. And so it's a place that will be familiar to both our traditions and a very welcoming place. The prior has already made it clear how much they're looking forward to hosting this first meeting of the third phase. It's also a very evocative, very beautiful place that will provide the tranquility and the space for some very serious talking.
And the meeting goes on for 10 days, doesn't it? Can you tell us a little bit about the way the talks proceed?
It's a long meeting because people come a long way and there's an importance in the themes that we're discussing. I think, as with previous dialogue meetings, it's a little bit top-loaded in that in the first few days we will be following quite a strict programme, looking at how the dialogue is to unfold, what our expectations are, laying down the ground rules, getting to know each other a little bit, and introducing the members of the dialogue to the history of ARCHIC and to the issues that we're going to discuss. The second half of those 10 days is a little bit less planned because we feel that themes will emerge during those first 5 days, that directions that we want to follow, particular questions we want to look at, things that we want to perhaps deepen our understanding of will arise. And so as the dialogue goes on in the latter half, I think there will be a full programme, but it will emerge as the programme progresses.
This, you say, is the first meeting of the third phase. Just recap in a few sentences, if you can, for us, the first and second phase, and also how this will then progress, how long, perhaps, this third phase is expected to last.
It's the third phase of a continuing dialogue. So, though we call it ARCHIC 3, the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission 3, there's actually only ever been one ARCHIC dialogue in three phases. The first two phases produced a range of agreed statements on a variety of topics that are of interest between the two traditions. The agreed statements on the Eucharist and ministry have been officially received by both the Anglican Communion and the Roman Catholic Church, and so have a certain standing in the history of the dialogues. They're a very important way of assessing the relationship between the two traditions over the last 40 years. We don't know how long ARCHIC 3 will last. It really depends on how the discussions go. Other things arise, other issues come up, other events befall the two traditions, and so in a sense we see what happens. But we do know that we're committed to being there as long as it takes.
The other question, I suppose, is how much is this work that you're doing going to be received by the rest of the church? As you say, the documents are then presented to the churches, aren't they? How easy is it to make this work really the work of the whole church?
It's a very important question. Ecumenical dialogues, like ARCHIC, have never seen that they're an end in themselves or that they're the whole of ecumenism. They've only ever seen themselves as part of a much bigger process, which involves reception at grassroots level, parishes, schools, communities, at a leadership level, bishops coming together, at the way that the two churches work and pray together. And ARCHIC is very aware, perhaps more aware than ever, that these dialogues that take place need to be complemented and take place within a context of other things going on. When the Holy Father was in Great Britain, he set a programme before all the Christian communities there of working together to bring the gospel into the social, political discourse of the nation. That's ecumenism as well. And so we're aware that our documents, whatever we produce, need in a sense to be fed into that wider context. We need to produce them in a format that can be discussed, received at all kinds of levels by bishops, by leaders, but also by ordinary Christians of both traditions.
In the Anglican Catholic world, the situation is slightly complicated now by the setting up of the new ordinariate for former Anglicans, now Catholic, some of them Catholic priests. Is this likely to affect the work of your next phase of the Archic Dialogue?
We've always said that the path of traditional ecumenical dialogue is a different path from that of individual or group conversion. The Vatican Council itself makes that clear in its document on ecumenism. And so we don't see our work lying within that framework of the ordinariate. It's a different issue. Our work is to stress the traditional relationship between the two traditions, between Anglicans and Roman Catholics, that has been expressed over 40 years in Archic. And so, though the ordinariate is an extremely important aspect of the landscape and the relationships between the two churches, it won't in itself be something that comes into our discussions.
Much of the talk about the ordinariate has been speculation and not based on what's actually going ahead. And I'm trusting that it's not going to affect the climate very much at the talks themselves.
Alison Barnett-Cowan heads the Office for Unity, Faith and Order at the London-based Anglican Communion Office, and she'll also serve as the other co-secretary for the forthcoming Archic talks. I contacted her to find out more about the mood in the Anglican world ahead of this new and crucial stage of the dialogue.
I think the expectations are quite high because there's been a lot of talk about Anglican-Roman Catholic relations in the media over the last year, and this is an opportunity for the official theological dialogue to get to work on the important questions that are between us at the moment.
Tell us something about the theme, what you think will be the most important issues on the table at this meeting.
Well, at this first meeting, I don't suppose we'll get too far other than planning the agenda for the way ahead for the next 10 years. It'll be a matter of building community and trust in one another, surveying the work that was done in Archic 1 and Archic 2, and establishing the platform on which these talks will be held. The topics, of course, are ecclesiology and ethics, that is, the relationship between the local and the universal church, and how the local and universal church together discern right ethical teaching. And those are both very lively topics in both of our communions right now.
As you say, there has been a lot about Anglican-Catholic relations in the media, and not all of it very positive, particularly regarding the difficulties created by the new ordinariate. How is that likely to affect the climate, if you like, the atmosphere at these talks, do you think?
I'm trusting that it's not going to affect the climate very much at the talks themselves. Much of the talk about the ordinariate has been speculation and not based on what's actually going ahead. And the ordinariate per se is not actually the topic for the theological dialogue. We will have an opportunity on one of the evenings informally to update everyone on what's actually going on. And at this stage, that ball is really in the court of the Episcopal conferences and their discussions with local Anglicans about how the ordinariate will be put into place. So I think we can probably note that, but put it on the shelf and get on with the work that's to be done between us.
Tell us something about the selection of the people who will be taking part, who will be representing the Anglican Communion for these talks.
Right. For the Anglican way of finding people was to write to the primates of the provinces of the Anglican Communion, and based on the nominations we received, we tried to get a good balance of skills, particularly around the discussion of ecclesiology and the question of ethics. There's not necessarily too many people who do both of those, so it was to make sure we had a balance of each. We wanted some continuity with Archic 2, and so there's a member and a consultant who were part of that. We wanted to make sure we had some women and some laity represented. I'm a little disappointed we didn't have a better geographical distribution, and that's really because we just didn't receive very many nominations from what's popularly called the Global South. We do have a bishop from Southern Africa, and we have a theologian from Singapore. But I'm sorry we didn't have any nominations, for example, from Latin America.
There is, of course, the question of the difficulties and the divisions within the Anglican Communion at the moment. How much is this affecting, perhaps, the difficulties overshadowing, in a way, the lead-up to these talks?
Well, I'm not sure the difficulties surrounding the talks. I think what will be interesting in the talks is that those the varieties of views will be represented within the Anglican team, and so it will be interesting to see how the team will work together. But we're not particularly afraid of sharing with Roman Catholics the fact that there are lively and divisive questions among us. I think that's part of our ecumenical obligation, is to talk about who we are honestly with our ecumenical partners.
Thanks there to Alison Barnett-Cowan, Head of Unity, Faith and Order at the London-based Anglican Communion Office. And earlier you heard Monsignor Mark Langham of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity. Friday, February the 11th, marks the feast day of Our Lady of Lourdes, when the Catholic Church celebrates the World Day of Prayer for the Sick. Pope Benedict has issued a special message for the occasion, reflecting on the mystery of suffering as a way of making us more attentive towards the needs of the sick and their carers. One person who has dedicated his life and work to this particular ministry is Father Peter Scott, healthcare advisor for the Diocese of Westminster, senior lecturer in healthcare at St Mary's College, Twickenham, and national healthcare liaison officer for the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. In recognition of his work, Father Peter has just been awarded the Good Samaritan Medal by the Pontifical Council for Healthcare Workers, one of two British healthcare professionals to receive this prestigious award. I caught up with Father Peter at his parish in Shepperton to find out more about his work in the Westminster Diocese.
It's a very privileged position because it means that I'm more or less involved in the appointment of priests or religious into hospital chaplaincies in London. So that seems to be the mainstay of the work, and that seems to be when some of the more complex issues come to light, when we're trying to put a priest or a religious into a hospital. The hospital itself can be either quite cooperative or they can question what we're there for. And so I work on behalf of the bishops and on behalf of the person that we're trying to get in there to make that process as smooth as possible, but also to make it quite clear to the hospital what the Catholic chaplain's contribution is.
Now, you say that people question that role, the role of a chaplain in a hospital. Is that sort of scepticism increasing as society becomes more secular?
There are two reasons, I think, for why they question it. First of all, there's an obvious reason, which is rationing. So they're thinking, obviously, about how can they make a cutback within their hospital, and they might use chaplaincy as a means to make that cutback. Obviously, then they think, well, do we need different sort of people from different denominations? Should we not just have a generic chaplain who can cover all faiths? And they might try that, not always, but sometimes they might try that a little bit. So you've got to be quite clear and remind them that reality really is that we have different faith communities, and that for the patient to feel safe in a hospital, that has to be respected for their recovery or for their ability to be comfortable to stay there. Then you've got to give them as much support as possible, and obviously different faith groups, and particularly the Catholic Church to our Catholic patients, provide tremendous support. That's one of the first reasons they might try that. The second thing might just simply be that they're a little bit uncertain about what the church is all about anyway. They may not be Catholics themselves. And so they're questioning, in a sense, with a new sight, what is this all about?
As you say, many of the people you're dealing with, though, in the hospitals won't be Catholic. They'll be people of other faiths or none at all. You can see the hospital's perspective when they're trying to make cuts and trying to see whether you can't perhaps work together, at least with other Christian chaplains from other Christian denominations. Do you do this very much or not?
We do work very well together. I mean, an important sort of characteristic of a Catholic chaplain in an English hospital is that they can work well within a Christian, well, within a multi-faith team. So there's a respect what the other chaplains from other denominations and faiths are contributing as well. And there's a support for that. So we really don't have a problem, in a sense, from our colleagues about getting a chaplain in. It's sometimes the problem exists actually from the hospital authorities, where they are trying to make an understandable cutback. I mean, again, I have to highlight as well that across the NHS, you know, there are constant cutbacks. So it's not just chaplains who are earmarked to be cut back. Nurses and doctors and different disciplines within healthcare also have to justify why they should be there. What's the importance of their particular contribution to the welfare of the patient?
It is an increasingly difficult area to be working in, isn't it, as the demands of cost-cutting, the government demands, rub up against what are really the very urgent needs sometimes of patients and those caring for them?
It is, but I think the patients and the staff would actually stand up, or they often do stand up and say that the contribution of the chaplain is incredibly valuable and contributes to the improvement of the patient, or if they are sadly dying in the hospital, actually to their being comforted, consoled, and able to die in peace in that place. So very rarely have we come across a trust which will not employ a Catholic chaplain.
It's also true that we're seeing in many places growing tensions over Catholic identity in healthcare, often pitting the needs of pastoral care against religious principles, particularly, of course, regarding pro-life issues. I imagine that you're also called upon to deal with this kind of tension in your daily work, aren't you?
And obviously, yes, and obviously we have to do that very sensitively. And what we'll fight with, I mean, the best way of actually dealing with that is for the chaplain to deal with it within that trust, within that hospital, rather than coming from on high and imposing some sort of policy onto the trust. It's much better it comes from the chaplain. So hence that kind of leads into the foundation degree of healthcare chaplains at St Mary's University College, where we, in our diocese, we offer them a degree program which is all about formation and which is all about, in a sense, giving the chaplain that confidence to kind of be a bit more of a witness to the values of the sacredness of life in that particular trust, in that particular hospital.
The work of a hospital chaplain can't be an easy one. You're dealing with suffering and pain a lot of the time. It's a job that I presume needs its own support network as well.
Yes. So one of my other roles within the diocese is to call together the chaplains and provide them with a little bit of informal formation. So we have study afternoons, and also if I can, and with my assistant, I've got a very good assistant who's a permanent deacon, is to whip round and see the chaplains as often as we can, certainly to be available to them so that we can support them in some of those difficult situations. You know, we had a whole spate of major incidents a couple of years ago where the chaplains were right at the front line of that. And it was just making sure that after that event that they felt that they had someone to talk to who would understand and would give them an opportunity to sort of deal with what they'd seen and what they'd been part of.
When you say major incidents, are you talking violent attacks?
Yeah, you'd have, sadly, you'd have 7/7, which is when we had those bomb attacks within the London tube system, the train system and the bus in Tavistock Square. But also you might have fires and gas explosions and stuff like that, or train crashes as well.
How much of a priority is this work concerning healthcare, do you think, for the church today? Again, the church is hard pushed to find people, priests, to staff these kind of different ministries. What kind of priority is given to healthcare, do you think, today?
I think for the church would admit, certainly in my own diocese, that at the heart of the church is the sick. And the heart of the mission of the church is to serve the sick, is to be there for them. So certainly, I'm certain of the other dioceses in my country as well, it would be a high priority that we would provide chaplains to support the sick. Obviously, there is that sort of theological response that we're giving, the importance of serving Christ in the hospital. But there's also the support on a practical level that if you provide a chaplain in the hospital, you're taking some of the stress off the priest in the parish as well. But I would say very much at the heart of the church is the desire to serve the sick.
You've been awarded this Good Samaritan Medal by the Vatican's Pontifical Council for Healthcare Workers. What does this mean to you? How will it help you, perhaps, in your work?
I am actually very honoured by it, but also very surprised, simply because, you know, I work with such a great group of people, so it's lovely to be kind of highlighted and earmarked, but totally surprised by it. How will I use it? I think it's a wonderful opportunity as we get near this important feast on Friday, the World Day of Prayer for the Sick, is just to highlight the role of the sick within the sort of Catholic Church, that they are the centre of our sort of concern and our response. So I think that's the way I would use it. That's the way I'm trying to use it, certainly within the diocese.
How is this occasion, this annual observance, the World Day of Prayer for the Sick, how is that marked there in Westminster and indeed throughout the country, throughout the United Kingdom?
Certainly within the United Kingdom, churches, parishes are encouraged to have a special mass for the sick. So the sick are brought to the churches and anointed with a special sort of mass of anointing. In Westminster, obviously that's encouraged. We have a central mass for the sick on the 19th of February. We couldn't get it for the 11th, so we've had to put it a week later, in which the Archbishop will celebrate and all the bishops. And we've put out an invitation to all the parishes to send sick and carers to that special mass of anointing. We've been doing that now for 4 years, and it's sort of growing and growing and growing. So we really do have it's a lovely celebration, a very profound celebration.
Quite a counter-cultural celebration too, in a society which places so much emphasis on beauty and health and well-being.
It is, but isn't that something of the witness of the Church, really, is to keep reminding ourselves that the sort of reality is that, yes, we have a period of our life when obviously we do sort of show some physical beauty, and then we kind of just go off into a different stage and we sort of take on a different kind of personality and shape and everything like that, which is still beautiful. But we go through different stages, and it's just important we highlight that reality. I don't think it's too counterculture. I think most people admit to it. Maybe there's a bit of escapism in the media rather than a denial of what life is all about.
And also a bit of a fear of confronting sickness and death.
Yeah, it's quite a strange thing, because I think that's quite paradoxical, really, because often in the soaps you'll see that some of the greatest storylines are to do with someone dying or being, you know, sort of diagnosed with cancer or something like this, and then there'll be a great kind of drama to do with that. So I think on one level we obviously are quite scared of it still, but on another level we still do somehow confront it a little bit. I mean, again, you can't really escape from it. It's probably something you don't wish to happen, but the fact of the matter is it's going to, and I think we're all very much aware of that.
Finally, is there any particular anecdote from the work that you've done over these years that really brings home to you the importance of the job that you're doing, and indeed the work of all hospital chaplains?
Yeah, I think the thing about being a hospital chaplain is that it's not what you bring, it's what they bring to you, what you learn about God through them. I remember a girl called Zara, who was 8, and I was looking after her family as she was dying of cancer, and her family found it very hard to deal with. And she loved receiving Holy Communion, and she one night took her family out of the ward just a few nights before she was dying, and she said to them to look at the moon, and they looked at the moon, and she said, you know, one day you won't see me, but in the same way that you'll see the moon at night, you'll know that eventually you will see me. You know, I'll be with Jesus. And I always remember that was a tremendously honest and profound thing to come out of an 8-year-old, and really just so supportive and loving to her family. She'd sort of worked it out. So you learn more from them than they learn from you. It's a tremendously privileged role.
My thanks there to Father Peter Scott, healthcare advisor for the Diocese of Westminster and National Healthcare Liaison Officer for the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. And that brings us to the end of today's programme. Thanks from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for listening. Don't forget you can join us again at this same time tomorrow, or find all our news and feature programmes on the internet. Simply look us up at www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio, Laudato Jesus Christus.